You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
From our studio to yours, this is Various Artists.
Ahi ahi mari e, tēnā koutou katoa, ko mea tōku ingoa.
Ko Sophia tōku ingoa, nō mai haere mai ki Various Artists mō tēnei wiki. Welcome to the show, how are you, Mea?
I'm good, how are you, Miss Thing?
I'm in exam hell, but yeah. Otherwise... fine.
Fine.
Yep. It's literally all fine.
Yeah, it's all gonna be okay. I feel like I'm like your support person.
Yeah, I'm really leaning on you today and leaning on this plush toy that we for some reason have.
She did bring in the plush to the studio.
And you know what? I needed that.
And I'm in support of it.
Thank you so much. Anyway, we have a lovely show to get you through for the next hour. What have we got?
Yeah, I caught up with artist Eva Juring about her current show on at the Arts House Trust at Par Homestead Under the Bridge. So what have you got?
I caught up with curator of contemporary art at Gus Fisher Gallery, Lisa Beauchamp, about their current group exhibition, What We Choose to Remember.
He aha ofakara, we would love to hear your thoughts on these pieces. So tukupata he mai, you can text us on 5395 rima toru iwa rima wai mai rane, or give us a call in the studio on 309-3879.
Also, after the show, koe e ware ware e ahe na koutou te whakarongo ki e nei kōrero anō, hei pakihere roki roki maronga i te pai toku toku o irirangi poho, me haere ki 95BFM ira kati.com. You can catch all of these chats and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com.
Oh, that's a good art!
What We Choose to Remember is a group show bringing together artists Hedia Anderson-Meter, Kirkan Ergen, Tara Hengsapkul and Kuli Moyanga Stone Maka, currently showing at Gus Fisher Gallery. Together, through their respective practices and materiality, the artists question and inquire into ideas of nation building and national identities, each contemplating different histories of their respective geographical and political landscapes, questioning the way we remember these pivotal moments. With a plurality in voices, the space invites a reflection on the multiplicity of experience, but also the closeness of these respective accounts. As a whole, the exhibition asks us to reflect on these narratives and connect them back to our present. If this is how these moments in history have been remembered, how will we remember our present when it too becomes history? I had a corridor with director and curator of contemporary art at Gus Fisher Gallery, Lisa Beauchamp, about the show, the artist's works, and these thematic conceptions that bind them. What We Choose to Remember presents this really thoughtful inquiry into this idea of nation building and contemplates our knowledge and the way we remember these moments in time or histories over time to shape national identities. It surveys this idea in the context of Aotearoa, Tonga, and further abroad, inviting a reflection of these concepts respectively within each geographical and political landscape, as well as their resemblance to each other. I thought we could start by speaking a little bit as to the kaupapa of the exhibition as a whole. Are you able to speak to these ideas which bind the exhibiting artist's exploration?
Yeah, I think you've summed it up really well there, actually. But yeah, I suppose the starting point for the exhibition was, I mean, it was informed by, I suppose, the kind of current kind of conflicts going on around the world, and thinking about, you know, looking back at pivotal moments in history and thinking about how, you know, seminal moments of kind of conflict or trauma or kind of significant events, how legacies have been created and how those histories have been passed down over time, and then thinking about the present day, you know, say in 50, 100 years, how will current events be remembered and what will the legacy be of these events? So I suppose it's, you know, it's a mammoth kind of theme or kind of topic to think about. But the way we've done it is by inviting kind of four artists, and actually, you know, each of them are touching on really kind of significant kind of events or kind of moments that have affected them personally, as well as their kind of heritage or kind of what they kind of relate to in their kind of world. And so it's got this kind of macro, but it's also got, you know, the kind of personal and the individual. So it's positioning the kind of individual within those kind of wider narratives.
Mm. This exhibition is bringing together, as you say, four artists, and I'd love to speak to each of their works a little bit more specifically and kind of what drew you to their work as well. Let's start with Turkish film producer Kakan Ergun. This is the first presentation of his feature-length film Heroes in Aotearoa, which sees him consider a defining moment in the establishment of the Turkish nation-state and its relationship with Gallipoli and the campaign in World War One. Are you able to speak a little to this work specifically and how it kind of connects to these central themes and what we choose to remember?
So Kirkin's work, it's the first work I kind of came across that really informed the whole exhibition, actually. So I saw a version of it at the Sydney Biennale last year. And yeah, I wasn't familiar with his practice before that, but I think it was a great introduction to the way that he works as a filmmaker. And he's always kind of interested in kind of lesser known histories, being Turkish as well. You know, the kind of Gallipoli campaign is kind of very central to their kind of national identity. And he was actually commissioned by the Australian War Memorial Museum a few years ago to make a work around Gallipoli. And I remember him saying, you know, he was kind of said, look, you know, if you want me to do this, it's going to be, you know, I'm going to do it, but you might not like all aspects of it, you know, I'm going to be truthful. And what he's produced is, I think, an incredible, incredibly meaningful and nuanced film that looks at kind of both sides of how this kind of huge conflict is cemented in different nations' histories and the legacies that it's then kind of created. We're showing the full kind of feature-length film, which is 90 minutes, but we've had people in the gallery watching it kind of over and over because it's so captivating. And I think, you know, he's really, I mean, the film, he shot it over a few years, and it's shot at Gallipoli, which is now, you know, you can, lots of people visit, and it's kind of this kind of modern day pilgrimage. And the focus is really on the kind of Turkish tourists and then the Anzac tourists. So people coming from Australia and New Zealand. And you kind of, throughout the film, you see how people from different nations are essentially, you know, kind of interacting with the site, but they're doing it in very different ways. But also the site is kind of guiding them through different routes and different experiences. So it's really fascinating to see how, you know, the Turkish tour guides, for instance, are kind of relaying the narratives of kind of Gallipoli to the kind of Turkish tourists. And there's a lot of historic reenactments that are performed for the Turkish tourists as well, which are very kind of emotional. Whereas the Anzac tourists, again, are taken on a completely different route. And in a way, they're kind of kept quite separate. And, you know, different stories, are kind of narratives are told. And so Kirkin kind of flits between these kind of two kind of different versions of events. And he's really interested in what he calls the tourism of martyrdom. So how these kind of events like this are memorialized and what it means to remember, what it means, you know, what does remembrance actually mean? What does it mean to kind of walk around essentially these, you know, graveyards now and these kind of, you know, very kind of powerful sites and think back to what happened, but also think about its connection to the present day. So yeah, the film, you know, it taps into ideas of kind of national identity and, you know, you're thinking about, you know, these individuals as well that, you know, went off to fight and they were so, so young. One part of the film, he chats to a young New Zealand girl who has visited as part of like a tour group, and she had a kind of relative that fought in Gallipoli. Yeah, she's kind of moved to tears by like the ceremony and the playing of the last post, and just thinking about, you know, when I watch that part of the film, I'm kind of thinking, well, you know, current conflicts, how are they going to play out in years to come, and what are going to be the narratives that are going to be told? And they're going to be disparate legacies, you know, they're going to be legacies that people disagree with.
Mm, I think it's so interesting to have those different perspectives captured in one place, and to see these, as you say, different memories of this event in time, which is very divisive, and people are going to have very different experiences and connections to that, and to see that in one space is good for reflection.
I think a very powerful moment of the film for me is the end of the film, where people are signing the visitor book, and yeah, kind of flicking through the pages, and you see the comments that people are writing. Most are kind of writing kind of "lest we forget" and things like that. But then there are comments like, you know, "don't ever invade us again. What were you doing here?" And you kind of realise that actually, you know, these legacies are still very, very present, and that division is still very present. And I suppose, yeah, it's kind of fascinating to think about that, I think, in kind of the contemporary context.
I want to talk about some of the other artists as well. We've got Kule Moeanga Stonemaker, who's created this major new large-scale Ngatu Tauli blackened bark cloth for this exhibition. It's furthering his interest in the relationship between Britain and Tonga, and making reference to these this relationship between Queen Salote Tupou III and Queen Elizabeth through these repeated motifs adjoining English and Tongan flags and phrases. Would you like to speak a little bit to this work, and I guess what drew you to Maka's work for the show?
Yeah, so Stone has created a new Ngatu Tauli for the exhibition, and it's informed by a previous work that he made for Christchurch Art Gallery. And he's, through his practice, he's Tongan, been living here for a long time, and he's very interested in the kind of relationship between Tonga and Britain, and how that has played out over time. And the kind of focus of this piece is, it relates to a very kind of well-known moment, which is often kind of retold in Tongan history, which is the moment that Queen Salote attended the coronation of Queen Elizabeth II in London. And, you know, the streets were just filled with crowds and crowds of people, and it was teeming down with rain, of course, because it's Britain, you know. And, yeah, all the kind of, you know, royalty from around the world are all arriving in their carriages. And Queen Salote chooses to ride in an open carriage. And, yeah, she's known to have said that, you know, if the people of Great Britain can get wet, you know, in the rain for their queen, then so can I. So it was seen as this incredible act of respect, and it really endeared her to the British public. And so Stone has referenced that moment in this new tapa cloth. And he's really interested, you know, he will say, you know, there's this kind of pervading belief that, like, Tonga was never colonised, but actually, you know, he would contest that. Yeah, so it's bringing up lots of, yeah, conversations around kind of national identity, around colonization, but also bringing it back to the kind of personal and the individual, so the individual relationship between these two queens as well. And the way he makes the Ngatu Tauli is, again, kind of going back to the traditional roots and how they make those works in Tonga. And he's making the black kind of ink. And then, yeah, there's lots of kind of symbols. So he's kind of adjoining the kind of Tongan and kind of English flags. He's written the kind of quote from Queen Salote on there. And also, I feel like the way we've displayed it on the wall in the gallery, it kind of looks like this huge flag as well. So it's kind of, it has lots of different reference points. But I think it's a really powerful work in the way that it speaks to, I suppose, the development of national identities and how things become ingrained in a kind of national consciousness, you know, and that pervasiveness of a story like that and the power of a kind of story like that.
100%. Yeah, it's such a powerful work. Mm. The show does have another video projection by Tara Hingsapkuls titled You Lead Me Down to the Ocean. Mm. Interested in the political legacies of war and the military's enduring influence in Thailand, the work shows a video of a tank resting on the ocean floor, encircled by overgrown algae and sea life. Talk to me a bit about this work. What really stood out for you in this work?
Yeah, so Tada's work, so yeah, it, I suppose the main kind of visual is this kind of projection of this tank on the ocean floor, which is accompanied by some letters. So there's letters, copies of letters written in Thai, and the letters are from a soldier, a Thai soldier fighting in the Vietnam War, and they're letters between himself and his wife back home. And then there's also a kind of smaller video that shows, kind of relays some of the letters through a kind of narration. And then there's also some posters taken from, kind of collages taken from his artist book. So it's a kind of multifaceted installation. So Tada grew up in an area of Thailand that was kind of occupied by American military. So his practice, or throughout his kind of practice, he's been kind of interested in looking at kind of particular kind of repressed histories in kind of Thailand's past. And yeah, this work focuses on kind of revealing the role of, yeah, Thai military in the Vietnam War, which not a lot of people know about. I know I didn't. And again, he's bringing it back to the personal, and the letters, which we provided translations for, really kind of reveal, yeah, the difficulty, or the, you know, the really intense situation that this soldier is being put in, that he has been told he has to go and fight. And, you know, he's, the letters are, you know, in part kind of revealing, you know, the role he's playing and his duties. And then there's kind of incredibly tender moments of like, oh, I, you know, I tried to get this gift for our daughter, but, you know, things like that. And, oh, have you put this money in our account? And, you know, so those kind of domestic, intimate, daily moments that don't go away, even though he's in this completely kind of loaded, incredibly dangerous context as well. Mm. And the image of the tank is really fascinating. So that was part of a government initiative following, yeah, following the kind of the, their role in the Vietnam War. And they had, you know, all these tanks and kind of military equipment. And the, there was a governmental policy that the Queen at the time kind of supported, whereby they kind of basically sunk these tanks into the ocean. And they found that, it's kind of bizarre, but yeah, the fish population loved them. And they became these kind of coral reefs that, you know, these killing machines effectively then became life givers, really, for kind of, you know, enabling and supporting kind of the marine population, and for helping the fish population to thrive, which then kind of helped the fishermen in the area as well. So, you know, it's a really powerful image, and it's quite, you know, it's a surreal image as well to kind of see when you come in the exhibition, because it's such a loaded image. But also a tranquil image as well. But you've got that real contrast between, yeah, this kind of death machine effectively that's been, you know, so a symbol of war, to something that has become now defunct and changed into something else. So in a way, there's this kind of positive message. And in the same year they sunk the tanks, there was uprisings in Thailand, and the army, there were kind of protests, and the artist's close friend was shot by sniper bullet. So you've got these incredibly potent and traumatic events that kind of are intertwined within the installation and within his memories of those moments in Thailand's history as well.
I think it's quite interesting what you said there with that juxtaposition between this, like, on the face of it, quite tranquil imagery and the heaviness of everything behind it. I picked that up as well, because you kind of feel, I don't know, not guilty, guilty's the wrong word, but you're standing there and you're like, this is peaceful, why is this peaceful? Which is, it's quite strange.
I always think it's like we're so desensitized as well to images like that, that, yeah, it's kind of testing our kind of reaction as well.
Mm, for sure. Lastly, I wanted to talk about Hedia Andersen Mehta's paintings. She's presenting an Aotearoa perspective on these ideas, addressing Aotearoa's colonial history and its ongoing impact on Māori lives, portraying these intimate moments of everyday lives, as well as her recent series of paintings on the Hīkoi Motutiriti to Parliament in November last year. What can be said about Andersen Mehta's work in the show and these ideas of remembering history and national identity in Aotearoa?
Oh, I think they're critical, and I think what I really wanted to do with the show was to kind of bring it back to Aotearoa and bring it back to the present and think about, you know, as I said before, and kind of like in the future, in say 50 years plus, you know, how will the Hīkoi, for example, and the kind of current assault on kind of Māori history and tangata whenua, how will that be remembered, and how will that be how will that narrative be kind of intertwined within a kind of broader history? So I was really, really keen to show some of Hiria's paintings from that she painted about the Hīkoi. They're very intimately scaled works, but, you know, incredibly powerful. And they capture particular, there's three pieces that capture particular moments along the Hīkoi. And yeah, the title for each one is like, you know, includes Toitū Tutility. So it's that kind of reaffirming as well. You know, I always think that, you know, Hiria's practice I've been a fan of for a long time, and her, you know, her previous paintings, most of which have been kind of intimately scaled as well, kind of show those kind of domestic, intimate kind of moments that she shares with her whānau on the marae, kind of preparing food and, you know, those kind of maybe kind of quieter moments. And these, again, are, you know, they're politically, you know, those works are still political. And with the Hīkoi, you know, I know she felt that she kind of had to produce those, and they were really important to produce. So I hope when people come to the exhibition, they'll, you know, they'll think about these histories, I mean, differently, but then hopefully think about it in relation to the present day context as well, and think about how we interpret difficult histories that we ourselves are involved in, around us, that are happening all the time. I suppose the role that we can play in helping people remember those through a kind of nuanced and kind of open lens. I think, you know, I always think what we're doing with our exhibitions as well is we're asking people to continually question things, and to question and be open, and to think critically, and to not maybe accept the kind of first narrative that they might hear, you know, and to be aware of other perspectives. So I think what really comes through the exhibition is this kind of plurality of voices and this multiplicity of perspectives that are coming through the artist's works, and they're kind of asking us to consider moments in time from different angles. And I think, you know, in the current context, but I think always, it's important to consider other people's perspectives or where they might be coming from, as well as our own, so we can kind of build a greater understanding of why things happen and why people might have those views. So I think hopefully it's an exhibition that encourages us to kind of question and also be accepting.
That was director and curator of contemporary art at Gus Fisher Gallery, Lisa Beauchamp, speaking to me about their current group exhibition, What We Choose to Remember. The show is on at Gus Fisher Gallery until the 13th of December.
Only positive critiques. Honest.
Various artists.
You're listening to Various Artists on 95BFM. We will be right back. This is Georgia Knight off her latest album, which came out today. Debut album.
Wow, we get along so well. I feel like I've known you my whole life.
I know, it's crazy. I'd love to see you again.
Sorry, I just have to ask. Your hoodie is so random. What is 95BFM?
Oh, I knew this was too good to be true.
What? Wait, where are you going?
No!
Show the world exactly who you are with our range of classic 95BFM merch. From the BSA slogan t-shirt to ringer tees and hoodies, get yours now at twotonesmerch.co.nz.
Okay, Meadow, we can't lose again, or it's off to the factory. Go, Meadow, go! No, other way! Don't you want to live?
Gonna get there, good horse! Headway wins the Spring Cup!
Oh, no, Meadow. I won't let them take you, Meadow. We'll find a way. I just saw a documentary about a basketball-playing Labrador. Maybe you can learn an unconventional sport, too.
Pony Ping Pong with Matt and Aaron, bringing as much entertainment to your Friday night as a Shetland pony skee-balling the table edge. With a mix of mashed downs, candid conversation, cheap shots, and mystery celebrity nakedness. Pony Ping Pong, Friday, 9 till 11 p.m., only on 95BFM.
West Coast, chopping.
Regan, wake up.
West Coast.
Honey, you're having those strange nightmares. Oh, no! No, it's not!
1 out of 10 on both coasts!
Oh, God! Father Damien, it's happening again!
Looking for tubular swells? It's the 95BFM Surf Report. Is the West Coast gnarly? Is the East Coast bogus? Do people even still use these words? Find out every morning on Breakfast and every afternoon on Drive. The Totally Radical Surf Report, proudly brought to you by the dudes and dudettes at Progear.
Various artists, so you can go to the opening for more than just the snacks.
Eva Durin is a multidisciplinary artist and recipient of the Arts House Trust and Dunedin School of Art Graduate Exhibition Scholarship 2025. Eva works within spaces of sculpture, ceramics, audio and installation, in which she navigates the complexities of personal identity through her experience as a first-generation immigrant. Her current exhibition at the Arts House Trust at Pa Homestead, Under the Bridge, follows Eva's journey as she retraces the path of Aotearoa's first Chinese immigrants, visiting these historic sites of the gold mining settlements of Lawrence and Arrowtown through tracing the path of the Clutha River. Throughout the journey, Eva collected these organic materials of the land's temporal memory, bringing them back into the studio in which the organic materials were transferred onto pieces of material that Eva then hand-stitched into hundreds of xiaobao that form a riverbed along the gallery floor, bringing together a beautiful display of collective memory and dialogue that speaks to the quiet strength that has passed through generations of Chinese immigrants. I caught up with Eva about the show and overall practice. Would you like to start off by introducing yourself and your overall practice a little bit?
Thank you, Maya. My name is Eva Durin. My family name is Ding, D-I-N-G. I've recently decided to give myself a new name, Durin. I'm literally taking the meaning of it, feeling I'm on a journey of something, as we all are, from birth to death, from one place to another. So my name is Eva Durin. I'm a sculptor. I came to New Zealand from China about 12 years ago, lived in Auckland for a few years, and moved to Dunedin. I enrolled in my studies at the Dunedin School of Art in 2020. My art practice started with ceramics, as I studied for a diploma in ceramics during the first 2 years at art school. Then I finished my BVA in sculpture. That year, I started exploring different materials and making methods. After completing my honors in BVA, I continued my studies in the Master of Fine Arts at the Dunedin School of Art. And I'm currently in my final year and will graduate in September next year. I guess that was because of some reflections on my immigration journey. Over the past 12 years, so my practice has always had an interest in social topics, such as gender and identity, especially when these issues intersect with broader contexts, including race, different cultural backgrounds, and of course with different political systems. And recently, I've found myself more focused on my personal experience and memories and the relationship between my own memories and the collective cultural memories. There's this contradictory feeling living in a different country, and these differences are something I find very interesting to keep exploring. So yeah, I'm glad I have chosen art. And I feel so lucky to be able to communicate through art about something I don't know how to put into words.
Mm. Your current exhibition, Under the Bridge, exhibiting at the Arts House Trust at Parr Homestead, showcases a beautiful body of work that includes hundreds of hand-stitched charbel that form a winding riverbed along the gallery floor. They form a riverbed that kind of links back to your research for this work, where you retrace the path of Aotearoa's early Chinese immigrants along the Clutha River. What influenced you to set out on this journey, and what was the experience like for you?
This project, from start to finish, is about a year and a half. It didn't start with the idea of making xiaobao, but quoting traditional Chinese quotes like my late grandmother used to do when I was a child. I remembered that she was always sewing, and she had made all my toddler clothes and her own clothes and made quotes as well. It was this memory of her quotes that made me feel safe and warm and became something I wanted to reconnect with. I have always felt a bit lonely because of my cultural identity as a first-generation immigrant. The past decade living in Aotearoa, New Zealand, had been a great experience. At the same time, there were moments of alienation and disconnection, a sense of being in between, not quite sure where I truly belong. I don't want to, nor should I, completely abandon my traditional culture, I think, but I have been challenged to make choices to fit in. So I started to look at the past and the Chinese people who came to Aotearoa, New Zealand, a long time ago, and try to understand how they adapted this new land and the new culture. And that's how I started reading things about the history of the gold rush in 1860s and decided to revisit the mining sites, especially those that the Chinese miners had lived and worked before. Then I found out their journeys were a lot harder than mine, such as their harsh living conditions, residing in a camp outside the town, and the pull tax that differentiated them from the others under the historical colonialism context back 160 years ago. The journey had given me a lot of back and forth thinking about how to get in touch with these miners in my imagination, as we were both first-generation immigrants. We must have had lots to share with each other. I had brought my own childhood experience of feeling cared for and loved by my grandmother, and I wanted to share this love with them as well. So the work eventually became a montage of things, jumping between my conversations with my late grandmother and my memories and my imagined conversations with the first generation Chinese miners across time and space.
And how did this journey of retracing this path of early Chinese immigrants influence your creative practice, particularly this body of work?
I was thinking of a similar question a few days before about what had influenced my art practice. The journey of retracing the historical mining campsites itself didn't really directly influence my art practice. It's more like a space or a background where I can practice my own way of thinking and making. Mm-hmm. What had really influenced my art practice, I'd say, were the collective cultural practices that were restored in my childhood memories, like what my grandmother did, my mother did, and other Chinese people did. These memories shaped me and my current art practice. As I mentioned before, it started with sewing traditional Chinese quilt last year. I was looking for a shelter to feel safe and warm, a sense of protection, I guess. The making process was very therapeutic. I felt like I became my grandmother somehow when sewing, like putting thread through the needle, stitching, and then pulling it out and tying it at the end. Felt like an overlapped moment of memory and presence. I think of if we all had some memories restored for moments of comfort. I don't know, a flavor, a smell, a thing, a place, or someone's face, someone's voice, or a touch, a hug, a feeling. It was me. I was looking for this moment of comfort. And I simulated dialogues in my head while making a body of work.
How beautiful. And
thank you.
Yeah. And these forms themselves, these intricately hand-stitched xiaobao, are filled with these beans and grains. Are they in reference to a particular form or memory?
Yeah. These xiaobao came from the form of a little pouch we used to play with in China as children. I did a bit of a research on how to translate xiaobao into English properly. There is something called dodgeball, right?
Yeah.
It could be quite similar to do xiaobao, I think. For xiaobao, it's a little sandbag sewn with off-cut fabrics. And the material that parents can easily find at home, and filled with beans and grains that are restored in the kitchen, or sometimes just filled with sand. As xiaobao translates in English literally, a sandbag. Xia means sand and bao means bag. So basically, two kids on each side tossing a xiaobao to each other, and the one in the middle dodges. I got hit once badly by someone's xiaobao filled with kidney beans.
Oh, no.
Yeah, it was painful.
Yeah.
So I got home and asked my grandmother to sew me another one. Sew a stronger xiaobao to fight back. And she didn't do it for what I demanded. Instead, she had asked me to reflect on the pain that I had at that moment and reimagine how painful it would be if I did the same thing to others. That was the particular memory that drew me to transform the making of quotes into the making of xiaobao. And this transformation of the form in making means a lot to me. For me, making quotes means making a shelter to hide in when feeling hurt. But making xiaobao, I quoted a thin layer of inlay into each xiaobao to make them lighter and softer than the traditional ones. As for me, it is a choice to refuse to pass on pain to others. So if the quotes were the moments of comfort, xiaobao are the reactions of what I chose to do after the pain.
And do you want to speak, you already have talked about this connection with your grandmother, but do you want to speak a little bit more to the process of making these forms? What was it like for you?
Yeah, I first cut the fabric into 6 square pieces and then laid out a thin layer of inlay and sewed them inside out like a cube. And after sewing each joint line, except for leaving the final line to turn the form inside out again and then to fill the grains and beans into it. I made different sizes. Since I've done hundreds of them, I don't want them to be uniform. Some are quite large and definitely not the size of xiaobao anymore. The weight was about a balance. I didn't particularly measure how many beans I put into each bag, but I would manually hand weight each one to feel the right balance. Then I sewed it up. The process was quite long. It took almost 1 hour to sew each of them for from the karting to the finishing. Yeah, I got the faster though in the end since I've sewn hundreds of them.
Yeah.
But it felt just like sewing quilts I did last year. It didn't feel tedious. Instead, I felt quite connected.
Yeah, I imagine it would be quite meditative after a while.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, and also circulating this project is this Chinese proverb that you reference, which translates as fallen leaves return to their roots. How does this proverb feed into this project?
Yeah, thank you for mentioning that. Fallen leaves return to their roots in Chinese as 落叶归根. It's a metaphor of saying no matter how far one travels, eventually they shall return to their hometown, reconnect to where they belong. A sense of belonging and connectedness with the land and the living space, I think. Many of these miners had died on this land in Aotearoa, and their ashes were never able to be sent back because they sunk into the ocean during the shipping. I visited the camping sites in late autumn and early winter, where I saw the land was covered with these fallen leaves and branches. I got quite emotional seeing those things. So I picked them up and brought them all the way back to the studio, tied these fallen leaves and branches onto the fabrics, and then I used indigo dye to trace them with the tie-dye method, the traditional method Chinese people use to dye their fabrics, I think in some of the other Asian countries as well. So I hope these shabo have become something beyond the traditional shabo. As for me, they carry the memories and stories of the land where the Chinese miners lived.
And the installation of the xiaobao is quite beautiful, referencing this riverbed, but also it has this layered association to the accumulation of memory and time. Do you want to talk a bit more to this choice of installation as well as its layered meaning?
Yeah, the installation had turned these xiaobao into the stones in the riverbed, but they're lighter, softer, and warmer than the literal stones. I hope to bring the counterintuitive feelings to the viewers in thinking of what actually can become in the future after so much water under the bridge. I guess it is my way of expressing my hope that these heavy things become lighter, whether they are the stones from my past immigration experiences or the stones where they used to find the gold at that time.
And also included within this work is this wonderful audio element. Do you want to speak a bit to this element as well as its importance within the experience of the work?
It is a 35-minute audio narration. As I mentioned before, during the making, I simulated these imagined conversations with my late grandmother and these miners across time and space. I wrote them down and turned them into this storytelling. I shared it with people because there are so many first-generation immigrants who may have had similar experience to mine. That's how we communicate throughout, right? To those who have similar living experiences, we resonate with the familiarities. And to those with completely different experience, we exchange our unknowns, I guess.
Yeah, that's so wonderful. Such a nice pairing and being able to hear those conversations.
Thank you.
And lastly, what are your hopes for viewers as they engage with this work?
That is a big question.
Yeah.
And it is something completely out of my control. There will be 1,000 engagements from 1,000 viewers, I think. And each with their own perception, and each is unique. But I appreciate this uniqueness.
That was Eva Durin speaking to me about Under the Bridge, which is on at the Arts House Trust at Parr Homestead until the 18th of January.
Yes, darling, but is it art?
We'll be right back with the Arts Guide. Keep it on the beat.
The power is on, and sometimes it's off. And sometimes it's charging, and sometimes it's not.
It's the 95 BFM Art Guide on various artists. It's paintings in that.
This week in the wonderful world of art in Tāmaki Makaurau. As mentioned on the show, Gus Fisher Gallery's group exhibition, What We Choose to Remember, is on now until the 13th of December.
Also mentioned on the show, Eva Durin's Under the Bridge is on at the Arts House Trust at Pa Homestead until the 18th of January.
Tomorrow is the last day to catch Still Growing Up by Gavin Hurley on at Melanie Roger Gallery.
Chemistry, an exhibition by Emma McIntyre and Timothy Webby, opens tonight from 5:30 to 7 p.m. at Coastal Science, so head along to the opening.
Echo, an exhibition by Tara Kasabawal, Erica Holm and Naro Morali, is on at Artspace Aotearoa until the 20th of December.
Blue Myrtle by Adrian Vaughan is on at Anna Miles Gallery until the 6th of November.
Room currently has two exhibitions on view, Stackrat by Finn Chadwick, Marilyn Jones and Bronte Heron, and Prelude by Tess Walker-Elliott. Both are on until the 29th of November.
New paintings by Liz Moore and Erica Holmes Eunuch are on at Ivan Anthony until the 8th of November.
Hedia Anderson Mita's Pā Te Huarahi Ki Te Kāinga, Finding My Way Home, is on at Tim Melville Gallery until the 15th of November.
And Matthew Galloway's Watch History is on at Suma until the 15th of November.
Louise Bourgeois in Private View is on at Auckland Art Gallery Toyo Tāmaki as well. If you have something you want on the Art Guide, you can email us at arts@95bfm.com.
That was the 95BFM Art Guide.
Ko ira te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki, nei te mihi kia koutou katoa e kore o mai ki māua mō tēnei rā.
That's all for us on various artists for today. Ngā mihi nui to everyone who spoke with us.
Lisa Beauchamp.
And Eva During.
Nei rā hoki te mihi kia koutou e whakarongo ana. Thanks for tuning in.
And remember, you can listen back to all of today's pieces on 95bfm.com or check out our Instagram, 95bfm various artists for more.
Ka hoki mai mātou a tērā wiki. Next up is The Land of the Good Groove with Mari. My name is Sophia.
I'm Maya.
And that was various artists.
We'll catch you next week.
You're listening to 95bfm. Keep it locked.
Yeah, have a good Halloween.
Happy Halloween!
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.